From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, one of the stars of the opening night movie at this year's Nevada City Film Festival. Plus, Tahoe Night, the latest book by Tahoe area mystery novelist Todd Borg. And the eclectic sounds of Fish Tank Ensemble, a band that plays Balkan, flamenco, gypsy, and hot jazz music. First, one of the Sacramento area's top speech and debate teams is about to start its 2009-2010 year. Two team members and their coach join us to show what they do and what it's taught them. We'll start with the team's coach, Neil Foster, who also happens to be an attorney. Neil, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Do you have to work hard to recruit students to join the speech and debate team?
You know, recruiting at Mira Loma has been very, very easy. I think that's partly due to the success the team has had in the last couple of years, and also the enthusiasm and passion that the students that compete for us bring to the event.
When you say success, give us an idea.
Oh, well, geez, we had 21 students competing at our state tournament down in Los Angeles last season, which was a huge contingent, made us one of the larger squads at that state tournament. We brought 6 students to nationals with us, and we had some really good success in Birmingham in June at the national tournament. It's just been, you know, the regional tournaments as well, we have some success in. It's a very competitive region. And we've won several events. Safina here actually won the state championship in impromptu, which was a huge accomplishment for her and for the team.
Wow. Well, Safina Miklai, welcome.
Thank you.
So you're a member of the team.
I am.
And tell us about why you're interested in speech and debate. Have you been doing it for a long time?
I started my freshman year on accident, actually. I tagged along with a friend to a meeting, and it turns out in speech and debate you get to talk and argue with people. So it turned out to be a really fun hobby, which is what high school students are generally really good at. And after that, I started to fall in love with going up and talking and being able to express your thoughts on a wider range of topics. And the event that I do is you really get to talk about anything, and that's very fun.
Tell us more about impromptu that you won the statewide prize in.
Impromptu speaking is a very specific type of speech. It's very fun to do. It's also very easy. Basically, you get a topic and you have 2 minutes where everyone looks at you and you get to prepare what you're going to say. And so you get your topic, you have 2 minutes to prepare, and then you speak for 5 minutes.
Whoa.
Yes.
Do you find that easy?
Now, yes. But originally it was a little difficult just trying to organize your thoughts and trying to realize what you're going to say. You have 2 minutes, everyone's staring at you, you're pacing and your heart starts racing. But after that, it's kind of easy. You just get to talk about whatever, organize it in some kind of comprehensive format.
Give us an idea of the kind of topic they give you for that impromptu.
Oh, chocolate.
I've had all kinds of topics from chocolate to dog. Shelves, and then also something like Barack Obama. And
so just a word or a name, perhaps?
It can be a noun, a feeling, an idea, a thought, a quote, a current event. It can be anything.
And how do you set about structuring your thoughts so you sound articulate and that you're starting somewhere and going somewhere when you only have 2 minutes to prepare?
Generally, I try to think of 3 things I'm going to say. Usually, maybe like a personal story, a book that I've read recently about the topic, or something in history that's happened that relates to it, and try to take those 3 ideas and organize them into some kind of speech.
Also with us is Ananda Chowdhury. Ananda, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're the team captain, right?
Yes, I am this year.
Tell us about your background in speech and debate. Was it an accident for you?
I'm not sure if it was an accident or fate, but my sophomore year, speech and debate was around 2 years before I actually came to Mira Loma. But my sophomore year, my friends were doing it, and I think that day I didn't have my ride with me because in Mira Loma we carpool a lot. And so I decided to tag along with one of my friends. And then I was at the meeting, and I saw Neil and Safina, and I was just intrigued right away, and I've been in there ever since.
Do you have a specialty like Safina?
Yes. I compete in public forum debate. It's one of the newer debate events in speech and debate. Basically, every month there's a new topic, and it usually consists with whatever's happening in the news. So generally what's happening in the news cycle and current events that are relevant in America.
I'm talking with 2 team members and the coach of the Mira Loma High School speech and debate team. The coach is Neil Foster. The team members with us are Ananda Chowdhury and Safina Miklai. We asked you beforehand to give us like a short sample of the kind of thing you do with the hottest topic of the day, healthcare. Neil, could you give us an idea of how the 2 team members are going to approach this?
Certainly. This is sort of based on the public forum debate that Ananda was just talking about. Essentially, what we're given is a resolution. That's a statement. One side is going to affirm the resolution. The other side is going to negate the resolution. So what Anindo and Safina have prepared is a short speech with a resolution, some definitions, and some contentions that Safina is going to be arguing for. And then Anindo is going to be cross-examining her on her logic, her analysis, and her underlying factual stuff.
Great. Well, let's get started.
All right. Assume the following hypothetical. One out of six people in a nation does not have access to health insurance. Furthermore, 36% of that nation's citizens who have health care are underinsured. This same nation spends almost one-sixth of their gross domestic product on medical coverage, but still cannot provide for its citizens. Which nation could this be? The United States of America, the wealthiest nation with a GDP of over $13 trillion, spends, according to the World Health Organization, a higher portion of its GDP than any other country, but ranks 37th out of 191 countries according to its performance, and 72nd in overall level of health, which compels me to affirm today's resolution. Resolved, that the United States healthcare system ought to include a public option. The definitions for this round are as follows. The United States healthcare system would be defined as the status quo healthcare system as it is today without reform. A public option will be defined as a government-sponsored health insurance program that will coexist with the current private healthcare providers. The affirmative's reasoning today is threefold. Contention one. Currently, we're overspending on healthcare, and we should be getting more out of it. As the current economic crisis plagues the nation, it is important that we allocate our resources carefully. According to a 2007 study, The Long-Term Outlook for Healthcare Spending, by the Congressional Budget Office, spending on healthcare in the United States has been growing faster than the economy for many years. Total spending on healthcare would rise from 16% of the GDP in 2007 to 25% in 2025, 37% in 2050, and 49% in 2082. Clearly, that's not sustainable. According to the CBO, over two-thirds of actual government spending is on Medicare and Medicaid, and if we continue this trend, the government will have to spend an even greater proportion of its budget on health care. Contention 2. A working health care system requires transparency that the status quo does not currently have. Traditional private healthcare providers discriminate based on pre-existing conditions. For example, it would be nearly impossible for a citizen battling cancer to find medical coverage, or they would have to pay an exorbitant premium to receive care. Also, some doctors and hospitals refuse to treat high-risk patients to avoid tarnishing their reputations. Healthcare and pharmaceutical industries become the benefactors as opposed to the citizens of the nation themselves. According to one Senate study, profits at 10 of the country's largest publicly traded health insurance companies rose 428% from 2000 to 2007, while consumers paid more for less coverage. At the same time, the number of uninsured Americans rose 18.8%. Contention 3. We should protect the uninsured. 48 million Americans are uninsured, and when people are uninsured, they don't receive regular checkups and preventive care, which creates greater external costs to society. Diabetes and obesity, two of the nation's leading health problems, are both preventable, but when untreated can lead to stroke, heart attacks, and potentially death. The cost of treating one of these conditions far outweighs the cost of preventing them from happening in the first place. Emergency rooms are also clogged because of the number of uninsured Americans who are forced to go to the emergency room because they cannot make a doctor's appointment, or they've reached a life or death situation due to an inadequate healthcare system. In conclusion, by allocating our resources more effectively, improving transparency of the system, and ensuring the millions of Americans who are currently uninsured, we can drastically improve the health of this great nation as a whole. Not only the health of our people, but we can also restore the health of our economy, educational system, and even our national security. And perhaps the wealthiest nation in the world can also be the healthiest nation in the world.
Wow. Just so people who are tuning in, there's no one going to be standing up and yelling at anyone here. This is the Mira Loma High School speech and debate team doing a mini debate on healthcare reform. You just heard Safina Meklai and Neil, just briefly, that's a heck of a lot of research that's in there. Is that what you look for in your team members?
Absolutely. And the turnaround time for that research was pretty short. So these two know how to get to the material that they need to produce a productive and effective debate.
Now, Anindo Chowdhury is going to take on Safina.
Yes, I'll just be cross-examining her to find her logical points. So you're saying the government is spending so much now on healthcare. Won't adding a public option actually increase government spending and therefore eliminate your positive effects?
Well, it's important to look at the long term. If we can avoid spending over 50% of our GDP in 2082 by fixing some problems that we have now, it's important that we fix those problems in order to avoid massive spending in the long term.
Right, but with the public sector, you'll be effectively eliminating the private health sector. So wouldn't you just be moving all the private insurance back to the government, which would in effect increase government spending and take away profits for millions of Americans?
If you look at the growth of the private sector from 2000 to 2007, there was a 428% rise in profits in the private sector. So clearly, the private healthcare sector is able to compete with any public option that were to
arise. Right, but the resolution states that the United States ought to implement a public option. I mean, if we can reform the healthcare system without having Uncle Sam involved, won't it still be better by cutting costs?
Well, if you look at something like UPS, DHL, FedEx, and the USPS, they're all options for sending your postal service, your mail. But the law of demand implies that the quantity demanded of a good or service actually depends on consumer taste. So in layman's terms, if people like what they're getting, they're going to keep it. And thus, even if a public option were to arise, the private sector would still be involved and would still have profits in that sector.
Right, but the healthcare industry is what it is. It's an industry, a business. I mean, if we can keep people well and have people making money at the same time, isn't it better for America, especially to grow its economy?
Every Western industrialized nation has universal health care in place, including the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Canada, all nations which are ranking higher than the U.S. America is falling behind, and the solution is clear in a universal health system.
Right, but you're simply just giving us an ad popularum fallacy logic. Just because everyone else is doing it doesn't necessarily make it right for us to do it. The United States has been different from the rest of the world. I mean, we are mavericks. Having a healthcare system that's private, ensuring that people make money and also people being well, isn't this better for the United States? I mean, if we look at Canada, for example, their healthcare system is lacking. Although they might have universal healthcare insured by the government, there are millions of long lines for people to get insurance from their doctors. And private industry is more efficient than having government bureaucrats run it. So in effect, isn't it better to have capitalism still live in the United States while ensuring people to have health care?
If you look at the facts, there's currently 48 million Americans who are uninsured. And what's most important at this point is looking at those people who need insurance. We need to be caring for all Americans. 48 million is too high of a number for this country. We need to be looking to get insurance for those people.
Great. Well, that was very impressive. Aninda, were you just reacting to a speech you'd heard for the first time?
Well, we've prepared this speech before, Safina and I did, for the affirmative. But what happens in the debate round is this kind of speech is given. And as they're delivering their speech, we take notes, which we call a flow. And there we poke logical fallacies, some assumptions that can be challenged, and some other ways of getting the solution to the resolution without actually affirming it. So in this case, I was taking holes from her public option.
And in case anyone listening is getting all hot under the collar, bear in mind that neither Safina nor Aninda are necessarily expressing their own point of view on the healthcare exactly. issue. This is a debate. They are the members of the Mira Loma High School speech and debate team. Neil, how would this be resolved in the formal setting of a debate?
Well, the next step would be for the negative speaker to actually give a prepared speech, much like Safina's, that negates the resolution and also attacks Safina's assumptions. Then there's, you know, the speech rounds last about 30 to 35 minutes, depending on the type of speech. And then the judge in the room basically has to weigh whose arguments are more effective, who did the better job of analyzing the issue, and who ultimately wins.
Neil, did you do speech and debate when you were at high school?
I did.
Did it help you as an attorney?
Absolutely. It helped me most actually in law school because I could stand up to the professors when they were grilling me on cases. And the fear that you have as a law student is huge and immense. You've got 100 kids, 100 people in the room with you. And if you screw up, everyone knows it and it's embarrassing. So you have to go in there with a lot of confidence.
And finally, Safina and Aninda, what are your career plans, if you have any at this point, Safina?
I'm looking to maybe go into law school or theater. So we'll see what happens and see where that takes me.
And Aninda?
I'm also interested in being a lawyer or I'd also like to be an economist as well. So,
well, all sound like terrific options. And I'm very impressed with what you both did today. Congratulations and thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the Mira Loma High School speech and debate team, Aninda Chowdhury and Safina Meklai, and their coach, Neil Foster. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the Nevada City Film Festival starts tomorrow with a film starring Mira Sorvino and Sacramento native Kate Levering. We'll talk with Kate and the film's director and producer. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Go to capradio.org/insight for links, images, and information about our topics and guests. Coming up in Talk of the Nation, topics include mental stress training for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's Talk of the Nation after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. The Nevada City Film Festival starts tomorrow night with a film starring Academy Award winner Mira Sorvino and Sacramento native Kate Levering. The movie's called Like Dandelion Dust. Its producers, brothers Kevin and Bobby Downs, live in the San Joaquin Valley. We're going to talk with several people involved with the film. We'll start with co-producer Bobby Downs. Bobby, welcome to Insight.
Hey, thanks so much. Glad to be with you today.
What is the dandelion dust that's referred to in the title?
The dandelion dust is from a reference in the book and the novel that the movie is based off of, where the family explains to the little boy, we have to disappear like dandelion dust.
And tell us a bit more about the book.
The book was created by author Karen Kingsbury. She's a New York Times bestseller, and she made a story that's very engaging. It's a story about two families that are fighting over custody issues of a six-year-old boy.
I'm talking with Bobby Downs, co-producer of the movie Like Dandelion Dust. Also with us is one of the film's stars, Kate Levering, who is from Sacramento. Kate, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
Well, I'm doing very well, thanks. You grew up in Sacramento. You don't live here nowadays. What did you move on to do when you left Sacramento? You were in theater, weren't you?
Yeah, when I left Sacramento, I moved directly to New York City, where I performed on Broadway for 8 years and also sort of simultaneously pursued television and film.
Yeah. What kind of theater were you doing in Sacramento?
I was brought up on the Music Circus stage. I don't think it's called Music Circus anymore. It's called...
A California Music Theater?
Yes. But back when I did it, it was under the tent, and it was about 110 degrees every night on stage.
Yeah, they've got a fancy thing now that looks like a tent, but is actually a modern facility, so it's a lot easier for all concerned.
And apparently has air conditioning, which is a step up.
What an innovation in Sacramento. So tell us about what happened when you moved to New York. Have things been going well for you?
Yeah, I was very lucky. You know, growing up in Sacramento, I already had built quite an impressive resume theatrically. And so when I moved to New York, I already had a lot of contact. And I started working right away. I did about 6 Broadway shows in the time that I was there. Just really, really lucky.
Are you still doing theater? It seems like you do a lot of TV and film nowadays.
I do, yeah. I'm currently on a television show for the Lifetime Network called Drop Dead Diva.
Okay.
So we just finished season 1. I've been shooting the television show in Atlanta, Georgia. Just finished season 1 and only been back home in California for 2 days.
And you've had either recurring roles or guest roles on a lot of very well-known primetime TV shows, including some that I really enjoy watching, like K-ville, Cold Case, CSI Miami, and so on. What was your favorite out of all those shows that you worked on?
Oh, I really liked doing... I did a show called Kevin Hill for a year. I really enjoyed that. I also really... Recently, I did a pilot, which never made it to NBC, but it was called Blue Blood, and I played a police officer. So there was lots of running around and firing guns and stuff. That was really fun.
What's it like working on a TV pilot that goes nowhere?
It's pretty devastating. I'm kind of the queen of those.
Was there a sense on the people working on the pilot that it wasn't going to go anywhere?
No, you never really get a sense when something's not going to go anywhere because everybody's so excited that they got the money to make the pilot. So there's a lot of optimism. And then, you know, you work on this project for a month or so and you wait and you wait and you wait and you keep hearing, you know, you just sort of hear rumors through the rumor mill. And then one day you kind of get the disappointing news that it's not going anywhere.
How do you build a career as an actress when you're working on things where you're coming and going, where you're working in a pilot, you don't know if it's going to become a series that will run for 10 years or if it's going to go nowhere, and when you're doing a series now for a lifetime, again, I guess you don't know when it's going to be picked up. How do you know what jobs you can take and you can't?
Well, right now, I mean, I can just go by what I'm doing right now. Right now, I'm still contractually obligated to Lifetime, and there's a lot of we've been getting great ratings, so everybody is fairly confident that we're going to get a season two pickup. But, you know, that's part of the struggle of being an actor, is that you have to pick and hopefully you get to a point in your career where you can pick and choose which projects you take. I hope I'm almost there. but, you know, it's just really tricky.
Kate Levering, she's an actress from Sacramento originally. She's in the movie like Dandelion Dust, which is the opening night film in this year's Nevada City Film Festival. The opening night gala starts at 7 tomorrow evening at the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley, and then the festival continues in Nevada City through Sunday. Tell us about the role you play in like Dandelion Dust.
I play Molly Campbell. She is the adoptive mother of Joey, who is the little boy. He's the true star of the movie. I hope you get to see it. Are you going to go, Jeffrey?
I hope so.
Okay, good. He's just such a little gem, beautiful actor. So Molly is the adoptive mother of Joey. Cole Hauser plays my husband. And we adopt this beautiful boy, and 7 years later, the biological parents come to try to take him away from us.
Also with us is the film's director. The director of Like Dandelion Dust, his name is John Gunn. John, welcome to Insight.
Thanks very much, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
There's a very well-known actress in the film, too, Mira Sorvino. What was it like working with her?
You know what? I had a great time working with Mira. I had a great time working with the whole cast, I have to say. We spent a lot of time casting this film and trying to find just the right people to play all these roles. And I was really, as a director, interested in finding actors who wanted to really dig into the material. And Mira is obviously one of those actresses. She's an Oscar winner, as was Barry Pepper, who plays her alcoholic, abusive husband. And so the two of them with Kate and Cole were really just a phenomenal cast for me to work with, and I was very excited to have all of them.
Where's the film set, and where did you actually shoot it?
The film is split primarily between Jacksonville, Florida, and a small town in Ohio. We actually shot the entire film in Jacksonville, Florida, with very few exceptions. There's a little bit of the movie that takes place in Haiti, and we did go to the Dominican Republic to shoot a little bit. But mostly, even the stuff that takes place in Haiti, we found areas in Jacksonville, Florida that worked for that.
So you're traveling around quite a bit, and you've got an Academy Award winner in the film. Does that mean it was a moderately large budget film?
No, actually, it was quite a small budget, especially for a movie that has an Oscar winner in it. But it's one of those you know, films that's based on material. It was based on a novel, a best-selling novel. We had a really good script, and we had a lot of actors really respond to the material. So sometimes you're fortunate in that way when you've got a movie that doesn't have a huge budget, but it deals with issues and that actors are drawn to, and it gives them an opportunity to do performances that are grittier and more layered than they might find in bigger budget movies. So that's the situation we had here, where we really held out to find just the right actors that wanted to dig into some really complex material.
Bobby Downs, you and your brother Kevin are the producers of the film Like Dandelion Dust, and as you said earlier, it's based on the novel by Karen Kingsbury. As I understand, you and your brother are planning to bring a whole slate of films based on her novels. Is that because you're working with her, or you just decided on your own part that you were going to do that?
Karen Kingsbury is really prolific. She writes about 4 novels a year, and she has a really rabid readership. She sold over 15 million books, and so we figured, since there's such a great audience and Karen writes stories, character-driven stories, that we like adapting into films and really gives actors, just like John was mentioning, a really great opportunity to dig into some really meaty roles.
You and your brother both live in the Central Valley, the San Joaquin Valley to be precise, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Is that where you're from?
Yep, we were born and raised in the San Joaquin Valley. Still live here, actually.
Yeah. How do you make movies while living in the San Joaquin Valley. Is that an advantage, or is it a minus, or is it irrelevant?
Well, I don't know if it's an advantage or not, but my family sure thinks it's an advantage. We live in a small town just outside of Visalia, California, a town called Exeter, and near Three Rivers, and it's just really beautiful. It's the best of what California has to offer.
Yeah. Who all is coming up to Grass Valley for the opening of the Nevada City Film Festival with the showing of your film tomorrow? Bobby?
Yeah, Kate will be there with us, and myself and my brother Kevin will be there, and we'll host a question and answer period after the film is finished.
Great. Well, thank you so much. The movie is Like Dandelion Dust. It stars Mira Sorvino. Also in the film is Sacramento native actress Kate Levering, who is on the phone with us. John Gunn is the director. Bobby Downs, he and his brother Kevin Downs, who both live in the San Joaquin Valley, are the co-producers of the film. It's the opening night movie in the Nevada City Film Festival, which continues through Sunday. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, mystery novelist Todd Borg with his latest thriller set at Tahoe. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. There's an Insight podcast. You can sign up at capradio.org/insight. Tomorrow, doctors and hospitals are moving towards greater use of electronic medical records. You'll hear the benefits of EMRs, along with privacy concerns. Also, a pet rescue facility just for cats. Plus, the author of the Plague Year trilogy of nanotech thrillers and jazz DJ Gary Vercelli joins us on the latest sound advice. There is a new mystery novel set at Tahoe out. It's Tahoe Night, the latest in the Owen McKenna series, written by Tahoe area author Todd Borg. Todd, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Glad to be back on the program.
How did you figure out what this novel was going to be about? Did you look to Tahoe for inspiration?
Well, I looked to Tahoe for inspiration, and I, being quite familiar with Owen McKenna because I dreamed him up, I'm kind of natural at coming up with stories that he would get involved in. And so this new story is about a woman named Leah Printner. And Leah is the writer, producer, director, and host of the popular TV show Tahoe Live, which, of course, is the go-to show for all news about Tahoe. And Leah gets unwittingly involved in a deadly art forgery that dates all the way back to early 17th century Holland. So for me as a writer, the fun part was thinking, okay, how am I going to connect up those Flemish painters hundreds of years ago with what's going on in Tahoe now? So,
did you have that connection in mind when you were starting on this, or did you come up with the idea of having these Dutch painters and then thought, really, how am I going to connect them to modern-day Tahoe?
I think it was the other way around. Owen has a kind of, there's an ongoing thread in all of the stories. Owen, as a lay person, is kind of interested in art. He doesn't know much about it. He hasn't studied it in an academic way. But he has a collection of art books, and he likes to look at the pictures, and he likes to think about it.
He knows what he likes.
He knows, yeah, exactly. Yeah, he doesn't know much about art, but he knows what he likes. And so I was kind of casting about for the art thread in this next book, Tahoe Night, the one that's just out, and I thought of an idea that would allow me to make it the crux of the whole story, a forgery about some rumored paintings that were lost in the early 17th century. And are they real or are they not? And have they actually turned up, and what's going on? And so it makes Owen rush around Tahoe and race to New York City and back to Santa Fe and then down to an area near Nevada City before he figures it all out and has to run back to Tahoe to do his final climax.
And for people who haven't read your books, Owen McKenna is a detective.
He is a detective. He's a former homicide inspector from the San Francisco Police Department. And after a tragic incident on the police force, he decided to quit the force and become a private detective in Tahoe. He thought that would be a more genteel way to earn a living. Ha ha. And like a lot of fictional detectives, he has a sidekick. However, his is a 170-pound Harlequin Great Dane named Spot. And so Spot is in all the books. He kind of upstages what goes on in the books and the scenes that he's in, but he adds a real nice levity to the stories.
My guest is Todd Borg, novelist. He lives in the Tahoe area. His latest is Tahoe Night. It's another in his Owen McKenna series of Tahoe mysteries. I'd like to ask you to read from the beginning of the book, the prologue. It's a very evocative passage.
Thank you. Reggie Deckman pricked her finger and squeezed her fingertip, milking another drop of blood out into the depression in the little white plastic watercolor palette. The aspirin she'd taken would keep her blood from coagulating, but not from freezing. The bitter wind sang in the tall Jeffrey pines. The March weather was out of sync with the early June calendar. 3 weeks before, when Reggie stepped off the bus from Sacramento, Tahoe locals had been celebrating a long stretch of glorious spring, sunshine so intense on the mountain snowfields that when Reggie stood in town and turned toward the sun-glazed slopes, she could feel the reflected heat on her face. Now winter had returned for a final assault. Reggie shivered. The drop of blood fell, but it missed the depression she was aiming for and hit the tiny pool of orange paint next door. Deep red swirled into the orange, ruining the mixture. Reggie squinted at the palette as the darkness came back, crowding in from the edges of her vision. It happened every time something went wrong. Her vision narrowed to a tunnel. The sounds around her became distant. Her heart thumped. It was difficult to get air into her lungs. Confusion overwhelmed her. She couldn't think straight. She didn't know what to do next. Reggie tightened her hands into fists. Focus. Concentrate on a color. Not the paint or the palette. Not the worry, not the fear, not the confusion, just a color. Take a deep breath and visualize.
Todd Borg reading from his new novel, the prologue from his new novel, Tahoe Night. How did you get the idea for that passage with all those colors and this person with a very distinct situation?
Well, my wife is an artist, and she has taught me that there are people like her who get their brain chemistry is actually affected by looking at color. And so where maybe a runner goes out and gets endorphins from pounding off a half marathon, some artists, maybe all artists, they get endorphins from looking at colors and looking at color combinations and relationships. And when certain colors are next to other colors, let me see if I can remember this straight. I think she says when a pure color is next to a grayed color, it creates a kind of a shimmer, the kind of the Rothko effect. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, it would be interesting to put an artist in the book in a historical sense. The character in the beginning of this story, Reggie, she turns out to be Leah's mother, the star of the story. And Reggie has some mental problems, and she left her husband and her young daughter when her daughter was maybe 3 or 4. And she's been racked with guilt ever since. And when she gets stressed and she starts to lose control, she finds that if she thinks about a color, just even visualizing a color, that it will give her the same effect as it does when you look at an actual color. And so I kind of ran with that idea in the beginning of the book, setting up the premise and so forth. So
interesting idea.
Yeah, color is a pretty powerful thing. You know, we all are affected by color and color is an intimate part of our lives, even though maybe only visual artists actually think in those terms.
That was from the prologue of your book. When I read a prologue, I sometimes ask myself, did the author start with this or end with this? And I'm not sure in this case. Did you start writing your book with a prologue, or was this something you added later?
I actually started with it, and then I went back halfway through the novel, I went back and adjusted it to make it work a little better for the story that was evolving. And then 2/3 of the way through the novel, I went back and readjusted it and rewrote it. And then as I got closer and closer to finishing the novel, I rewrote that prologue about 89 times to try to strike the right flavor so that it would set up the book, but also be satisfying when people get to the end of the book and they find out what really happened.
How much of an idea of the story did you have when you started with the prologue? It sounds like the story evolved quite a bit.
I think stories always evolve quite a bit. I know from talking to other writers that many writers are like me, where we will, before we ever write, we'll write a short prose outline, maybe 12 or 15 pages, and it will set up or outline the basic characters, what the premise is, how the story is going to build. But what happens is it's kind of like a roadmap. You get partway into the story and you realize you're going to change your direction, and so you take off in a new way. So you have an idea of what the story is going to be, but it continuously evolves as you write it, and you see opportunities for ways to diverge from your original plan, but in ways that will make the story better.
I see that an eating place in Tahoe has honored your creation, Owen McKenna, with an omelet. What's that?
Well, that was kind of fun. Owen McKenna periodically in a couple of the books has eaten at the Red Hut Breakfast Cafe. And in one of the books, I think it's the second one, there is a scene, and I have not gone back and reread it, so maybe I'll get this wrong, but I think the essence of it is the waitress says, oh, do you want your standard or your regular and Owen's omelet? And he says, sure. Well, when the Red Hut opened up their new fancy restaurant on the South Shore, the owner contacted me and said, she said, Todd, what's the deal? We had a customer in here who wanted to order an Owen's omelet. And she said, what's in it? And I said, I'm sorry, Kelly, I have no idea, but I'll find out for you. So I told my wife, because my wife has, I think, a better feel for the nuances of things Owen than I do. I said, the Red Hut wants to know what's in an Owen's omelet. So my wife came up with the basic plan, which was cheddar cheese, fresh tomato, salsa, and a dollop of sour cream.
Sounds good.
And Kelly said, well, I think we better have an Owen's omelet for sale at the Red Hut. So now you can go to the Red Hut and order an Owen's omelet. It's kind of fun, yeah, to have an omelet named after a fictional character.
Todd Borg, his latest mystery novel is Tahoe Night. It's another in his Owen McKenna series of Tahoe mysteries. He's got a whole bunch of readings coming up, too many to mention right now, but August 21st, he's at the Avid Reader in Davis in the evening, and August 22nd, the bookseller in Grass Valley at 11, and the Book Lovers Bookstore in Sacramento at 3. Todd Borg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, the gypsy, flamenco, Balkan, hot jazz music of Fish Tank Ensemble in our studio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Look for Insight on Facebook. We're at Insight on Capital Public Radio. The eclectic world music group Fish Tank Ensemble is in town. Fish Tank's music is very eclectic and includes gypsy, flamenco, hot jazz, Balkan, and more. The band is in our studio. Fish Tank Ensemble, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, let's start with Ursula Knudsen. You're a singer, violinist. You're also from Sacramento, right?
I am from Sacramento, yes, born and raised.
Yeah. What's your musical background? You're classically trained, I believe.
Yeah, I took classical voice in Sacramento, and then when I lived in Italy a bit, I had operatic training, and I played violin when I was a kid.
And was it your plan at that time to be in a wild and crazy group like Fish Tank Ensemble?
No, isn't life strange?
How did the group get started?
Oh boy, that's the $64,000 question. You know, I'm married to our violinist, and the basic story is that when he came to the States to visit me the first time, because we had met in Italy, he was looking for people to play with, and we somehow randomly found people to play with, and that group, particular group, met at a performance space in Oakland called the Fish Tank. So there comes the name, too, Fish Tank Ensemble.
Fish Tank Ensemble, and we're going to hear a song by you all. I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. What is it, Ursula? Or Georgi Stiepovich?
I think we're going to play Chokarlia first, right?
Chokarlia.
Chokarlia, yeah.
Chokarlia. What does that mean?
Nightingale.
Yeah.
In what language?
Romanian.
Yeah, it's also known as Sheva. I knew that song back in Serbia as Sheva.
You're from Serbia?
Yeah, I'm from Serbia.
Great. Well, let's hear Chokarlia performed by Fish Tank Ensemble in our studio. Thank you.
Cecina me, Cecina yoi yoi, yoi yoi. Sun Cecina, Sun Cecina yoi yoi, yoi yoi. Sale versa, zaproplia, rico resta, rico resta.
That's Chocarlia, performed in our studio by Fish Tank Ensemble. They're in town. They're playing Arnold tonight. They're in Reno tomorrow. Also Sutter Creek at the weekend and workshops in Davis. George Stiepovich, the bassist. Is that a traditional song or was it written by the band?
Chocarlia is a traditional gypsy song.
Are all the songs that you do traditional?
No, we play some originals and we are working on new material as well for a new album.
Yeah,
we'll try to focus more on original stuff.
The band's guitarist, Doug Smolens, is also with us. Doug.
Hi.
If people ask you what Fish Tank Ensemble's all about, what do you say? I tried to summarize what the group's about when I introduced you all. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, it's a pretty fair description. The way I like to think about it is that, you know, the gypsies, the Romani people, they traveled, you know, originally from India all throughout Europe and North Africa. And I like to think of the music as crossed the Atlantic now and sort of taken root in the States and is now we're starting to see, you know, new American gypsy music, basically. So
you're a flamenco guitarist.
Primarily, yeah. And I started out on, you know, flamenco and then started to learn these other gypsy styles, you know, because we do so many different styles in the band. So
did you start picking up those other styles because you were in the band or had you already expanded into them?
I had already, you know, heard, you know, Django Reinhardt and all this other, you know, Romanian music and, you know, music from the Balkans, which is just amazing. But I never really started to learn it until we started playing together.
Yeah. Ursula, where's the band based?
Mostly in L.A. We have Giorgio, though, in San Francisco. Now we make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the name of your latest album, Samurai Over Serbia. Where does that come from?
Actually, that comes from the fact that up until last year, believe it or not, and how would we have fit all of them in the studio, we had a shamisen player. Shamisen is a Japanese three-stringed lute. We were actually playing gypsy music with a Japanese instrument. We would even play Japanese songs. And through circumstances, we became a four-piece, sometimes five-piece. And so our last album has the shamisen on it, and we named the last song on the album Samurai Over Serbia. It just sort of came to us because, you know, it's sort of mixing these two elements.
Sure. Let's hear one more song. Doug, what's the next song?
This one is, what's it called again?
Espagnolette.
Oh, yeah. Espagnolette, yes. It's written by our friend Jean-Paul Manouche.
No, Jean-Paul Monchet.
Monchet, sorry. Yes.
Jean-Paul Monchet, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear it. Espanolette, played in our studio by Fish Tank Ensemble. Ursula Knudsen, how did you pick up the saw?
Very randomly. I just decided like 5-6 years ago I wanted to play a new instrument, and someone, a friend of mine, suggested to me the saw. And I picked it up, and I found actually that having played a string instrument and being a singer, it was really easy for me. It's the same intuition as singing. It sounds strange, but you sort of find the notes and the tones with your body intuition. So I really like it. Really,
well, it does have a kind of crazy human sound to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe a banshee or something.
People say they can't tell the difference between my saw and the voice.
And Georgi Stiepovic, I noticed that you have played, along with your gypsy Balkan stuff, you've also played with Slim Jim Phantom of Stray Cats fame and Lenny from Motorhead. Really?
Yeah, that was
But Lenny's fun. A bassist.
Yeah, that was a band with two basses. He played electric, you know, Rickenbacker bass, and I played upright bass.
What's Lemmy really like?
Oh, he's
awesome. A wild and crazy guy, too.
I love Lemmy. He's like a super nice guy.
Yeah.
Good friend.
Great. Fish Tank Ensemble. They're at the Cedar Center in Arnold tonight. Tomorrow, they're in Reno at the Studio on 4th. Saturday night, they're in Sutter Creek at the Sutter Creek Theater. They're also giving workshops this weekend at the Davis Arts Center Friday through Sunday, and I understand that spots are available. In the meantime, let's thank the Fish Tank Ensemble members in our studio, Ursula Knudsen, Fabrice Martinez, Jorge Stiepovic, and Doug Smolens.
Thanks a lot.
Well,
thank you so much.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producers were Kelly Minnemeyer, Ellie Fox, and Michelle Grafis. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. And hospitals are moving towards greater use of electronic medical records. On the next Insight, you'll hear the benefits of EMRs along with privacy concerns. Also, a pet rescue facility just for cats, plus the author of the Plague Year trilogy of nanotech thrillers, and jazz DJ Gary Vercelli joins us on the latest sound advice. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.